All right, buckle in. We are going places today. Going to space, gonna hit up a candy store, and my favorite, we are going to therapy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, July 5th. Glad to have you with us. In the spirit of the long weekend, we've got a bit of a travel-themed episode for y'all. Not intentionally, but just go with me here. Jeff Bezos steps down as CEO of Amazon today, 27 years to the day after he founded the company. And now he is off to space. He's turning his attention, among other things, to his commercial space enterprise, Blue Origin. It's scheduled to launch its first human flight, with Bezos on board, on July 20th. Not to be outdone in the billionaire space race, Richard Branson has scheduled his own flight with his own company, Virgin Galactic, for July 11th. The companies are competing for paying passengers who will turn extraterrestrial excursions into a business. As Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carina reports, there is not a whole lot of regulation when it comes to the final frontier.
One of the three other people on the flight with Bezos will be an anonymous bidder who paid $28 million for a seat, the kind of customer Blue Origin will be counting on.
Many of them are the same people that might do extreme scuba cave diving or climb Mount Everest, or they're looking for that thrill.
Greg Autry is a professor of space policy at Arizona State.
It's not as though you've got to have the right stuff in order to go to begin with. Basically, you go sign up.
Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic are offering minimal training to deal with G-force and zero gravity, but that's not even required by the government, says Joseph Kohler with the Center for Space Policy and Strategy.
The FAA is actually not permitted to provide regulation that specifically protects the health and safety of the flight participants and the crew and so forth.
That's a congressional mandate for this learning period of commercial human spaceflight. Federal authorities are responsible for making sure no one on the ground or in a plane will be affected by a launch, but the folks on board fly at their own risk, says Carina Dries with the Commercial Spaceflight Federation.
The entire purpose is to allow adults to buy flights so that the most innovative and safe companies can continue to innovate and expand U.S. leadership in space.
This learning period for commercial human spaceflight is set to end in 2023. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Sticking with our travel theme, if you look at the 2 days that led into the holiday weekend, that Thursday and Friday, the number of passengers cleared through TSA checkpoints actually surpassed the totals back in 2019. That is the first time that's happened since the pandemic hit. So yeah, travel is coming back, but I should say one piece of this travel recovery is still lagging pretty badly, and that is business travel. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Business travel is still down as much as 50% from pre-pandemic levels, and that matters to airlines and hotel chains, says Joanna Piacenza at Morning Consult.
They make up 10 to 15% of travelers, but they can contribute up to 75% for a company's revenues.
They buy premium air tickets at the last minute, book hotel suites, eat out on expense accounts. Morning Consult finds 3 in 10 pre-pandemic business travelers aren't planning a trip this year. Ellen Lewis at consulting firm LEK says some of that's thanks to lessons learned during the pandemic.
Technology, Zoom, and Teams will replace some meetings that would have occurred live going forward.
Lewis says other kinds of travel resistance come from management and employees.
CFOs have been able to reduce their travel budgets. Reopening those purse strings will take time. The productivity that people have discovered, they've found that they can be more productive by not investing time in travel.
On the flip side, says Madhu Unakrishnan at Airline Weekly, the new post-pandemic way we work might boost some domestic business travel.
Instead of having people come into an office every day, they may have sort of an offsite every quarter or every month.
Unakrishnan says the big question, can these new remote white-collar road warriors replace the big spending executives who used to book business class tickets to London at the last minute for lunch? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing. It was closed because of the fourth weekend, but we'll look at that cookout you had when we do the numbers.
We'll be right back.
So if you're a regular listener of the show, which obviously you are, you've probably heard about the podcast, This is Uncomfortable. It is a marketplace podcast that I host that is all about our relationship to money, how it makes us feel, how it impacts our decisions, our relationships. And recently I talked with someone, with a listener of the podcast, who deals with something a lot of Americans deal with, and that is anxiety around money. In fact, even before the pandemic, according to one national survey, about 60% of respondents said just thinking about their finances makes them feel anxious. For Aisha Salahuddin, she's felt anxious about money ever since she was a kid. In fact, she remembers exactly when it started. She was 13, living in Nigeria. There was a lot of political instability in her hometown, so her parents had sent her to a boarding school a few hours away.
Everyone else was so much richer. No one was from like the rural areas like I was. So it was a sharp contrast.
Thinking about your first days there, your first weeks there, were there like these markers of wealth that you could pick up on right away?
Yeah. So it was the first day and one of the girls was unpacking. The suitcase that she had was so big. It was like twice the size of mine. And I was like, oh my God, how much stuff do you need? It's just 3 months.
Aisha watched as this girl pulled out multiple pairs of shoes, just one after another.
And I remember she was saying, oh yeah, I got this in France over last summer. And I was like, what? You guys have been to France? I've never been on a plane. So it sort of, you know, kickstarted my major, I guess, money crisis phase. I don't know what to call it.
Lifelong money anxiety?
Yeah.
Aisha had come from a middle-class family, and suddenly she was overhearing kids talk about their 12-bedroom mansions and their shiny new bikes. Their parents would give them 6 times the allowance that she'd get each month.
Oh my God, it was just so lonely. I was like, why have I missed out on all of this?
Then one day, Aisha was lounging in her dorm when her classmate started complaining about how she wanted water, but was too lazy to run downstairs to get it herself.
And then she said, oh, please, can you help me and I'll pay you? I was like, wait, so you're going to pay me to get you a bucket of water? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, okay. And she said, I'll give you 1,000 naira. I was like, no, you give me 2,000 naira.
What?
She's like, okay.
You're trying to negotiate? Okay. From that point on, it became Aisha's mission to do whatever it took to close the cash gap between her and her friends. That very next day, she went room to room soliciting new customers. And not just to fetch their water, but to also braid their hair, run errands, whatever they need.
In the first month, I made 35,000 naira. So that was 30,000 more than what I used to get.
Wow.
And I didn't feel out of place.
But for Aisha, the money, it went from having a tangible value to having an emotional one. And soon, the thing that was supposed to be the solution had now become an obsession.
Oh my God. So because I was constantly always thinking up new ways to get money, it just really made me more anxious about money, even if I didn't have any use for it.
For Aisha, the years following high school were a blur of deepening money anxiety. Even when she graduated and went to college in the UK, the obsession followed her. And for a while, she would channel her old tricks, braiding hair for cash and selling things like coffee. Eventually, she graduated and became a journalist. And once she started making a decent enough paycheck, she thought, for once, money was no longer going to be the driver of her life. But now, at age 26, it still consumes her.
I'm not kidding. I'm always thinking about money. Like, when I say this, people think I'm joking.
Yeah, and just so I have a sense, like, when you say you're always thinking about money, is it like when you're in the shower and you're thinking about it before you go to sleep, you're thinking about it while you're cooking, are you thinking about it? Or is it not like that?
No, it's like that.
Oh, it's like that.
Aisha has tried budgeting hacks, listening to podcasts, using apps to manage her money. But the thing is, her problem is not a tangible one. Really, she feels like there's one solution she hasn't tried. Therapy.
I feel like I need to talk through, you know, a professional that can really help me. I always feel like, oh, therapy is for really serious, deeply traumatizing issues. So I'm still trying to, like, unlearn all of that.
I asked her if she'd be down for me to set her up with a financial therapist, which, yes, is a thing. And she agreed.
Hello.
Hi, nice to see you.
Lindsay Brian Podvin is a financial therapist based in Michigan who specializes in money anxiety. Lindsay told Aisha that all of us, more or less, fall into one of 4 big money categories: money avoidance, money status, money vigilance, and money admiration.
And Lindsay had an idea where Aisha landed.
Would it be okay if I told you some information about the admirer?
Yes, it does sound like me.
So the admirer is a person who, as the name implies, admires money. The idea of having money provides them with a sense of security. But the underbelly of falling into this admirer money script is that these folks tend to feel like they can't ever get enough.
And Lindsay tells her because the need for money has become unmoored from a specific purpose, it's turned into a loop of needing more money because she needs more money because she needs more money because, well, you get the point.
Oftentimes with these folks, because they don't have a why behind the reason that they want more money, they don't really get that fulfillment in the way that other folks might.
Lindsay encouraged her to identify concrete financial goals and to recognize just how much her childhood influences her beliefs around money, beliefs that can easily stay locked in our brains as adults. They talked for about an hour, and at the end of it, Aisha left feeling at least a little better. How did it feel to connect those dots in your life?
It felt so good because, I mean, for the most part, I'm always like thinking, am I just incredibly selfish, like always wanting more money? But then when she said, like, look, this is more common than you think, it made me feel better and less alone.
Of course, we've only got so much time on this show, not enough to air the full conversation with the financial therapist. But if you want to hear more of their convo and a lot more of Aisha's story, you can check out This Is Uncomfortable wherever you get your podcasts. Many businesses in this pandemic have been forced to pivot, to get creative, trying new tactics, reaching out to new customers. And for one centuries-old business, this last year, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, it's been a real test. And that gets us today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Ben Howie, and I'm the proud owner of the oldest sweet shop in the world, which is situated in the north of England in a small market town called Pateley Bridge. So the sweet shop was established in 1827 and it's situated in a building which dates back to 1661. With it being the oldest sweet shop in the world, we stock many, many traditional sweets such as our rhubarb and custards, our pear drops, and of course our Yorkshire mixture with fruit hard-boiled sweets. And we weigh it out on the Avery scales, which has a very unique sound when the sweets hit the pan. And then when the customer comes to pay, we still use a traditional till which dates back over 120 years. Obviously, we were affected by the lockdown. However, we've turned to our online side, which has proved well for us. And so despite the footfall being down, business is still looking up. We ship all over Europe at the moment, and Brexit has had an impact on us. We've added customs paperwork and ingredients labelling. But it's the customer base that we have within the UK, which is really quite strong, which have grown up with these sweets and has that little bit of nostalgia to them. Ever since I was a boy, sweets had always had a strong place in my heart, whether it was my mother or my grandmother bringing me to a sweet shop. And it was always like a little sweet treat that we always used to do on a Saturday morning, and that really brings back a lot of memories. The oldest sweet shop stood the test of time through wars and in times of troubles, and the pandemic was no different. So we're navigating out of the pandemic now, and we're hopefully looking forward to growing even further. And right now I think I'm just going to pop off and get some sherbet lemons.
Sherbert Lemons sounds good to me. That was Ben Howie. Thanks to our friends over at the BBC for that story. Let us know what's going on in your economy over at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
It's very empty. It's very empty.
When it comes to the tourism business, I would argue empty is the very last word you want to hear. But first, let's do the numbers.
Wall Street was closed today in observance of yesterday's Independence Day, but got some holiday edition numbers for you. Turns out even fireworks are subject to shortages and supply chain issues. Wholesale prices for fireworks in some cases were double or even triple what they were last year. Sellers had a hard time fulfilling all the orders, partly because of increased demand during the pandemic. The good news number for this 4th of July weekend, the average cost of a cookout is actually down from last year, but the biggest price increase is strawberries, which are up 22%. And if you're planning to throw some chicken on the grill today, because why not, you might want to check the USDA's website first. Because of possible bacteria contamination, Tyson Foods is recalling more than 8 million pounds of chicken products. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. Okay, so we're going to take a look at one sign of a recovering economy. Last year, when the pandemic hit, a lot of college students took a step back from school and enrollment plummeted. But some early reports from administrators and experts suggest that things may be turning around this fall. In Maine, lots of new students are coming from out of state, folks craving stability after an unstable year. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg has that story.
Our next stop is going to be the gym, and I know we have a hockey player on the tour, so that is our ice arena, is an Olympic-sized ice arena.
On a sunny afternoon, University of Southern Maine senior Fantasia Perez leads a small group of interested high schoolers on a tour of the college's tree-lined campus. Classes ended in May, but she's been busy ever since, showing off the school to prospective students. Perez talks up her favorite spots, from dorms and dining halls to the steep hill that's used for sledding in the winter.
With that being said, I will warn you, there are trees. So, you know, just don't sled into the trees.
In recent years, close to 90% of the students here have come from within Maine. But over the past few months, early deposits from out-of-state students are up by nearly a third across the state's university system. Perez has seen that, too.
We've had people from Alabama, California. I think I've sent letters to students all over the country, really.
The school says all that interest now has the college on track to boast the largest freshman class in its history this fall. It's a somewhat surprising trend, especially after a year in which college enrollment fell by nearly 4% nationwide. And David Hawkins with the National Association for College Admission Counseling says expectations for this fall weren't much better.
The bar was set so low, but there was so much pessimism.
But Hawkins says this year, early deposit numbers nationwide suggest that enrollment may bounce back.
There does seem to be some optimism at the college level that students are returning, that the yield numbers, the numbers of students who accepted offers of admission are fairly healthy this year, which is surprising a lot of institutions and frankly surprising us as well.
In Maine, university officials say they ramped up outreach efforts last year to reach new students. And University Chancellor Dana Malloy says the state was also boosted by generally low COVID-19 numbers, which enabled universities to remain open last year while colleges in many other states stayed remote.
That worked in our favor, and it told the story that, you know, that Maine in general was doing a good job and that we were ready to be responsive.
Administrators note that the numbers aren't final and could change before the first day of classes. But in Maine, officials say that if the trend continues, it could bring more young, working-age people into a state with the oldest median age in the country. Ava Martineau from New York will be an incoming freshman at the University of Southern Maine. She says she could definitely see herself staying in the quieter confines of the state after college. But for now, she's just happy to know that she'll be seeing her teachers and classmates in person next fall.
I did pretty much my entire senior year online, with the exception of, I think, like 5 weeks we had in person.
And Martineau says after a year and a half of remote high school classes, the last thing she wants is another year online. In Gorham, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
So we are going to stick with the young people beat for a little longer, but now we're going halfway across the world to Thailand. Young people in Thailand have already faced 3 economic crises, 2 military coups, and a number of natural disasters. And now they are facing the fallout from a pandemic that's put their economy on life support. And one area that's really taking a hit is tourism,
and makes up a fifth of Thailand's income. Thai authorities are hoping to open borders to vaccinated tourists, but right now the country is dealing with its worst wave of the pandemic. So, what now for millions of young people who depend on this industry to survive? The BBC's Laura Becker reports from the island of Phuket.
Warm azure waves still rumble over the golden sands of Phuket, but the only living souls on the beach are stray dogs searching for washed-up scraps.
Normally, in this beach, is Patong Beach. It's very popular, but look at this now. There's no people.
25-year-old Tiwasit Jarawanakul, or Jay to his friends, put all the money he had into a van business to transport tourists.
Yeah, it's very empty. Just feel it's very empty.
He shows us around the party town of Patong. It's now a shuttered wasteland.
I have to find another way that not in tourism industry. Everyone have to find new way to save yourself.
Jay's way to save himself is cooking and selling local pork with his sisters, and he's not the only one trying out new skills. 23-year-old Pachira Sujan is about to graduate with a degree in international tourism. She dreams of a job in the airline industry. For now, she's working in the airport canteen at her family restaurant.
It's very hard to find a job in this industry, and everyone gonna adapt themselves. Okay, if I think the only the negative, we cannot run my life. Yes, so why I have to think like in first step way.
Tourism was once a safe income in Thailand. It's the economic crutch of this country. Now it's new blood, it's young graduates are having to turn adversity into opportunity. The busiest place on the island is the vaccine clinic, the heart of the battle to save tourism in Thailand.
No tourists, have no hope, like hopeless.
Pirat Nasongkla is normally a tour guide. She volunteers here alongside taxi drivers, cabin crew and nightclub DJs, all in return for one meal a day.
We have no income for 1.5 years. No income, totally 100%. Our target, our focus is just need to open our island. Only one chance to open our island.
The race to reopen involves vaccinating 70% of the island to gain herd immunity, to try to welcome back vaccinated tourists by July the 1st. Thailand's limited supplies of vaccine have been sent here to Phuket, even as COVID-19 surges through parts of the mainland. What happens in the next few months is crucial, not just for the future of this industry and its young workers, but for the future of this nation's economy. In Phuket, I'm the BBC's Laura Bicker for Marketplace.
All right, this final note on the way out. I mentioned the Marketplace podcast that I host, This is Uncomfortable. We just wrapped up our fourth season, and it was all about scams. And in fact, this last year during the pandemic was, unfortunately, pretty scammy. Bloomberg over the weekend crunched some numbers from the FTC, and it found that there was a total of 4.8 million reported scams last year. That is a 43% increase from the year before. 43%, it's wild. A good chunk of those scams, about a third of them, were reports of identity theft. And I don't know about y'all, but I get what feels like a dozen scammy phone calls a day. Not sure the official numbers on that, but I feel like that has to have gone up too, right? All right, we've got to go. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. And I'm Rima Reis. All right, we'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.